Go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer. Right, so, can you turn the volume down a bit? Thanks. All right. So the idea that the dark matter could be some non-baryonic particle was put forward somewhere in the 1970s, and it was very soon in 1980, it was realized that any particle can be, whatever it is, whatever its mass, can be conveniently classified into one of three families defined by the thermal motions that these particles had in the early universe. And very soon after that, it was recognized that hot dark matter wouldn't work. A neutrino, light neutrino with a mass of a few electron volts wouldn't work. And that was clear from simulations, the first simulations here 30 years ago, that showed that a neutrino dominated universe wouldn't look anything like the universe of galaxies as we knew it in the 1980s. And it was also clear just a couple of weeks later that CDM was a much better match to the galaxy distribution. And this was already what's now become known as lambda CDM. 30 years ago, Louis, not 10. And so this kind of agreement with the large scale structure obviously encouraged the development of the cold dark matter theory, which now become the standard paradigm. Now, so of course, we'll like to confirm this paradigm by finding the particle, but as we've heard here today, nobody yet has done that. So in the meantime, it's incumbent upon astrophysicists to try and find out whether there are astrophysical constraints on the identity of the dark matter. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. So here's a plot that'll be familiar to most of you. That's a power spectrum of fluctuations in the early universe and recombination. These are large scales, small scales, and this is the familiar cold dark matter power spectrum. Here is a warm dark matter power spectrum, of which is different because it has a cutoff at some scale due to the thermal velocities of these particles in the early universe. They free stream out of small fluctuations producing this cutoff. And it's easy to show that a cutoff is essentially proportional to the inverse of the mass of the particle. And so, for example, if the warm dark matter particle is a sterile neutrino with a mass of a few kilo electron volts, then it turns out that the cutoff mass is at an astrophysically interesting scale, scales of dwarf galaxies. So what has what has astronomy told us about this power spectrum? Well, the microwave background probes the very large scales. The large scale structure probes these sort of scales, and there's an overlap between the two. And then there are also constraints here on smaller scales from the Lyman Alpha forest at redshift 2. But none of these observations distinguish between a sterile neutrino or cold dark matter, or between warm dark matter or cold dark matter. So from the point of view of astronomy, these two models are exactly identical on large scales. They differ on small scales that have never been probed by, or are beginning to be probed by astronomical observations. So I'm going to be talking about both cold and warm dark matter, but my interest in warm dark matter doesn't come from a desire to try to fix any problems with CDM. It comes from the fact that a sterile neutrino is possibly as well motivated as a WIMP. Some people would say that, not everybody would agree. And I think given that we don't have any constraints here, it seems to me they deserve equal airtime. So that's what I'm going to try and do today. So the interesting conclusion of this is that the astrophysical clues to the identity of the dark matter lie on these puny little galaxies on subgalactic scales, which are strongly nonlinear. And the way, of course, we try to see the implications of this sort of power spectra for dwarf galaxies is through simulations, which is a technique that is now mature, well understood, and allows us to make some quite rigorous conclusions about the comparison of these initial conditions to the present day universe. So let me begin with a movie. It'd be great to get rid of those lights. Is there any way to do that? Does anybody know how to do that? Here? Ah, Marty. Right, thanks. So this is a movie that many of you will have seen, the formation of a galactic dark matter halo, cold dark matter. This cold dark matter is part of the Aquarius series of simulations. Here's the redshift, here's the scale, and you see at high redshift it's already uniform, but quickly structure begins to form. In cold dark matter, it's powdered on all scales, and so you begin to see the formation by redshift 25 or so of these very small halos with mass of 10 to the 5 solar masses or so. And very early on, the sort of small-scale version of the cosmic web begins to develop. Here by redshift 15 or so, these objects already have 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7 solar masses, and by this time, these are the sites where the first stars in the universe will form, whose UV radiation will reionize the gas that is around. And you see here very nicely how a structure grows hierarchically. Lumps fall along filaments, and then when they collide, they merge together, building larger and larger structures, hierarchical clustering. And all sorts of interesting things happen. So look at this fellow. It's falls onto the main object here, which by now has 10 to the 11 solar masses. It goes through it, and when it comes out of the other side, there's this spray of particles. These are these tidal disruption effects. It comes back and gets even more disrupted. It seems to like it, so he comes back again for the third time, and eventually it will be either completely disrupted or just the little core would remain in the center. By redshift 2, this already has 10 to the 12 solar masses, nothing much happens, and that are the conditions required for a spinning cloud of gas to cool, condense, fragment, become unstable, fragment, make stars, and produce a galaxy. So that's what happens in CDM, and now let me show you what happens in warm dark matter, and in this case, it's exactly the same power spectrum, the same phases, except, of course, in the case of warm dark matter, the power spectrum is truncated on a dwarf galaxy scale. So here on the left is cold dark matter, here's time. Made this for television, so there's no redshift time. And you see here all sorts of things are already going on in cold dark matter, nothing in warm dark matter, because there's a cutoff, there's no small scale structure. Eventually, structure begins to form about redshift 15 or so, and these two, you can see the correspondence between them. But because there's no small-scale power, the power spectrum is truncated, this is sort of much cleaner, and none of these small-scale structures survives or forms at all in the case of warm dark matter. So that's the difference between them. Structure forms later, and there's, of course, no very little small-scale structure here. You can compare the two side by side, and cold dark matter on the left, warm dark matter on the right, and the main halo is identical, but the little halos, you can actually match them. The biggest ones are there in both cases, but all these small halos are absent from warm dark matter. Yeah, same phases. Now, so I'm going to show you results for several warm dark matter models with different masses. Here, the power spectra. So as the mass goes up, you need to remember the larger the mass, the smaller scale the cutoff happens, or closer to CDM, if you like. So the larger the mass, the closer the warm dark matter model is to CDM. So here are pictures of the various models. This is work by Mike Lovell, who's just finishing his thesis, and here's CDM. And these are all warm dark matter with increasing mass. And you see as the mass increases, there's more small scale structure. And for 2.3 keV, it begins to look a little bit, of course not much, but a little better, closer to CDM than for 1.4 keV. Now, there are two important predictions. Louis talked about those already that come out of these simulations. One is that there's a large number in the case of cold dark matter of cell bound substructures that account for about 10% of the mass. That's one. And the other one is that the main halo and the subhalos are all cuspy. And in warm dark matter, there's far fewer cell bound substructures, but they still make up a comparable amount of mass because the big ones are there. And as Louis said, they contribute most of the mass. Now, the main halo is essentially identical to CDM because the cutoff in the power spectrum is 1,000 times smaller mass. And the subhalos are still cuspy. Don't let people deceive you with cores. I'll tell you about cores later. But they're less concentrated than in CDM. And that's going to become very important in a minute. Now, so here's the first thing you want to do is count how many subhalos there are. Louis showed this plot from Aquarius. These are this mass function of Sohailo's beautiful power law over 10 orders of magnitude here with a slope of minus 1.9. So that is what happens in CDM. There's hundreds of thousands of substructures formed in the simulation. Now, what about warm dark matter? What is the Sohailo mass function in warm dark matter? Well, it turns out that it's not as easy as just counting, because if you look in detail at these filaments, you see they look sort of like the legs of alien. They're broken up into these little lumps, which look suspiciously artificial, and indeed they are. These are completely spurious, and we understand why they form. It has to do with complicated the noise properties of the discreteness of the simulation interacting with the cutoff in the power spectrum. So we know that, we know they're artificial, and there are techniques being developed by Thomas Bell, for example, and others to try and prevent the formation of these things in the first place, but these techniques are not mature yet. And so if we want to count how many halos there are, we need to find out which ones are real and which ones are spurious. Now, it turns out it's not that hard, because if you look closely, this doesn't look anything like you would expect. They're actually like little pillboxes. They're extremely flattened. And if you go to the initial conditions, you see that very clearly. Here are two blobs that are genuine, and here are where the particles are in the initial conditions. All these are spurious, and you see that they're immensely flattened, and that is the telltale sign. And Mark Lobel spent a year developing a sort of cleaning algorithm that allows us quite robustly to identify which of these subhalos are spurious and delete them from the calculation. And so here is the subhalo mass function in warm dark matter compared to CDM. And these are the various masses that I talked about. So you see, of course, what you saw by eye. These are the fake ones. These are the real ones. There are far fewer subhalos. But the number actually drops quite rapidly as the mass of the particle drops. So the number of subhalos goes up with the particle mass. And even though there's only 50% difference between this one and that one, here's a factor of 5 difference in the number of subhalos. OK, now, so the question then was, what about the density profiles, which was the other important prediction that I talked about? Well, here they are, density profiles for the 9 biggest subhalos in common in the 2 simulations. And they're color-coded here. Black is CDM. So here's the NFW profile. And the other ones are as function of stellar neutrino mass, if you like. And you see the order by mass. And as the mass goes down, then the density at the center drops. So these are less dense than in CDM in a way that is clearly systematic. So the subhalos in both cases are cuspy, and however, for warm dark matter, the central density goes down with decreasing particle mass. So these are the results of the simulations. But let me say why that is, so we understand exactly why this happens, and that is just simply what we saw in the power spectrum, that in warm dark matter, halos form later when the mean density of the universe is smaller, so they're naturally less concentrated. So here's a plot that shows a measure of concentration, function of redshift. Blue are CDM, they all form at high redshift, these most massive ones. And in warm dark matter, they form at lower redshift, and they're less concentrated just because the concentration reflects, in some fashion, the mean density of the universe at the time when the objects form, which is later in warm dark matter. So the question then is, how do we distinguish between them? There are ways to try and do that. And let me approach this in the following way. There are two problems that are said to afflict CDM, the satellite problem and the too big to fail problem. Now, this one is just a fake problem. This is made up. This is just PR. This is the dark side of science. This has never been a problem. There is a problem, but it's not this one. Now, this one is a problem, and let me tell you about these two. What I'm going to do now is tell you what CDM has got to say about these two problems, and then what warm dark matter has to say about them. And you've seen a minute. So, The satellite problem is the statement that we know there are about 25 satellites in the Milky Way, whereas there are hundreds of thousands of halos that form in CDM. That is the satellite problem, supposedly, which is not a problem. And the reason it's not a problem is because people who work on galaxy formation have known for a long time that it's virtually impossible to make a galaxy in most of these small subhalos. That's well known. It's been known for 30 years. Here is an example where here's the mass function, not of subhalos now, but of halos in the Millennium simulation compared to the luminosity function of galaxies in the real universe. So it's just the number of galaxies as function of luminosity. These are faint, these are bright. And you can see that these two functions are completely, have a completely different shape. In particular, they're far more, at least in the field, it's nothing to do with satellites. This is just the field galaxy luminosity function. Here, it's clear that if CDM is right, then there must be processes that suppress or make galaxy formation very inefficient in small halos. Only about 1 in 10 here successfully make a galaxy. And we've known for a long time what these processes are. It's just quite simple physics. Firstly, the fact that the gas is reionized at high redshift. It gets heated. When it's reionized, we cannot cool in these small halos. That's part of the solution. And the other part is that wherever gas cools, all it takes is one supernova to blow all the gas from these very shallow potential wells. So that's been known for a long time here on large scale, so the things that are not relevant for this meeting to do with AGN feedback. So these ideas have been around for a long time. They were applied to the satellite problem by Andrew Benson in his thesis in 2002. These are now satellites of the Milky Way. This is the luminosity function of satellites as was known in 2002. Here's the halo mass function. Here is the so-called satellite problem. And Andrew Benson in his thesis applied these very simple physics of galaxy formation to show that indeed galaxy formation is very inefficient in these small halos. This is where what you get if you have supernova feedback, and then with reionization, that's the prediction of the model. So let me show you this in a cumulative way. So this is the number of galaxies brighter than some magnitude. And this was actually quite interesting. Now, 10 years later, I come back to this plot with some measure of, you know, as you grow old, you become either depressed or the opposite. I'm on the opposite end. And this plot makes me go to that end because here he ran 100 models here. Here's the median, and here is the scatter. And one thing we realized then, we were worried at the time, was that it was very difficult to make the bright satellites. Only about 2% of cases made an LMC and SMC, and now we know through work with various people here, Louis Ries and other people who are not here, that in fact that is indeed the case in the Milky Way. And the other interesting thing was that Andrew predicted that there should be a population of ultra-faint satellites which were not known then but were discovered very soon after, which known, that roughly where the theory predicted they should be. Now this is not proof that CDM is the answer, it just tells you that, you know, this physics makes sense. All right, so that is the so-called satellite no problem, as it should probably be called. Now what about the too big to fail problem? Now it's more serious. And that has been very nicely, succinctly, and elegantly, and funnily expressed by Mike Boyle and Colchin in this plot that we've seen before. So what's plotted here is the circular velocity, square root of gm over r, as a function of radius. Now these are data for 9 dwarf spheroidals in the Milky Way. And for those, one can measure using kinematics the fairly robust measure, which is the mass inside a radius, which happens to be the half-life radius. So these are plotted, these are the masses at the half-life radii of these satellites. And there's 9 of them here. There's 3 even, these are the brightest satellites of the Milky Way. There are 3 even brighter ones, which are not plotted here, LMC, SMC, and Sagittarius. For those, you cannot measure these masses easily, so they're excluded from these plots. Now, the too big to fail problem is the statement that these Aquarius halos, which we let Michael use, are produce about a dozen or so very massive subhalos that are too massive to be compatible with the idea that they host the brightest satellites. Of course, you would expect the brightest satellites to be in the most massive halos, and that is not the case. You're allowed to subtract 3 because of the LMC, SMC, and Sagittarius, but you're still left with a lot of change, namely the simulations, or these ones, the Aquarius simulations, make these subhalos much too massive to host the brightest satellites. And that is the too big to fail problem that we've heard a lot about. Right, so now that problem shows up in other ways. It's definitely there. Another of my students, Owen Parry, did something quite daring, namely to do full gas dynamic simulations in one of the Aquarius halos, and it made a galaxy with satellites. First thing we checked was that the satellite luminosity function in the simulations agrees with the data. Of course it does, because it's physics. Same physics that Andrew had, simulations do the same thing. And so that's not a problem, but then he made this plot that was alarming, actually at the same time as Mike, so we were both alarmed, where at the same time, this is the luminosity as a function of mass for the satellite. So here's the same data that I showed you before, mass at half-life radius, that's Fornax, that's Draco, and so on. And here is where the simulations put those galaxies of that luminosity. So the simulations like to put the brightest satellites, obviously, in the biggest halos, but those are much too big compared to the halos that we infer from the data. And so this is another manifestation of the too big to fail problem. And you can do some statistics and find that CDM is ruled out at about a 94% confidence level from this data. Now, so is that the end of CDM? Well, no, because the Aquarius simulations was a big project, took a long time to do, and we were told when we started that the mass of the Milky Way halo was 2 × 10^12. Innocent as we were, we did that, that's what the observers told us, but actually it turns out that the number of these massive subhalos is a very strong function of the parent halo mass, not surprisingly, big things have big things in them. And so here's a plot that shows the number of subhalos above some maximum velocity, 30 kilometers per second, here in black, for example. And you see that the number of these massive subhalos is a very strong function of the parent host halo mass. Here at Aquarius, and they were at 2 × 10^12, scattered around that. It's also a lot of scattered in this relation, by the way. So that is where the too big to fail problem manifests itself. But what if the halo of the Milky Way is not 2 × 10^12, it's something smaller? What would happen to the too big to fail problem? So we calculated that in this paper last year with Jie Wang, and these other characters. And so what's plotted here is the probability of having 3 or fewer massive subhalos bigger than 30 kilometers per second as a function of the whole halo mass. You can read this as 1 - the probability that CDM is ruled out. Okay? And so this is an expression of the too big to fail problem. So it's the probability of having 3, you're allowed 3, right? The reason you're allowed 3 is SMC, LMC, and Sagittarius. Those you're allowed. It's the probability of having 3 or fewer as a function of halo mass. And you see, indeed, if the mass, Mike is right, there is 2 × 10^12 solar masses, the probability is essentially 0. CDM is ruled out. But if the mass of the Milky Way halo is 1 × 10^12, then you get a healthy probability of 20%. So it all hinges on the mass of the Milky Way. You can set a 95% confidence limit, which is 1.5 × 10^12. So if the mass of the Milky Way is greater than 1.5 × 10^12, then this too big to fail problem can be, in principle, fatal. There's a loophole I'll tell you about in a minute. So that is CDM. So how does warm dark matter fare? Well, let me do it in the opposite way. Let's do the too big to fail problem. Of course, warm dark matter doesn't have it because the density is less of the subhalos. Well, let me show you the plot. So here's the same plot that we just saw from Mike. This is one of the Aquarius halos in this paper, same as I showed before, showing the too big to fail problem for CDM. Now, this is what it looks like in warm dark matter. The problem disappears because in warm dark matter, the subhalos are less dense, and therefore these rotation curves all come down, and now you can fit the data with these curves. Interestingly, for this one, you're actually left with exactly the 3 LMC SMC, but that is just a fluke. So this obviously agrees very well with the data. So warm dark matter does not suffer from the too big to fail problem at all. What about the satellite problem? They do have a satellite problem. Bizarrely, warm dark matter has a satellite problem, but it's an anti-too big to fail problem. So if the mass of the stellar neutrino is too small, then just not enough subhalos to make up the ones we see in the Milky Way. So let me explain that. So here's cold dark matter, warm dark matter. At first sight, you'd say, well, piece of cake. This obviously doesn't suffer from a satellite problem. It doesn't even have the subhalos in the first place. No need for reionization and feedback to do anything. Indeed, that is true, but with a catch. So here are satellite luminosity functions for different stellar neutrino masses, 2, 3, 5, 20 keV. In all cases, that's the data. And let's take 2KeV. These are different halo masses, right? So here's observations, and here is what the theory predicts. Now you see the opposite problem. If the mass of the halo is small, there's just not enough substructures to make up enough satellites. So you can rule this out. Here, for example, if the mass is 2KeV, the halo mass better be about 2.5 times 10 to the 12th to get enough satellites. So this work by another of my students, Rachel Kennedy, and here is the answer. You can set limits on the stellar neutrino mass through this argument. So for a given mass, the model must predict at least the observed number of satellites, and that's a function of the halo mass. There are all sorts of assumptions. I don't have time to go through those. They're all reasonable assumptions, but here is the answer. So here is the Wondack matter mass on the x-axis. Here's the halo mass on the y-axis. And all this region is forbidden because here there's just not enough satellites to account for the ones we see, let alone the ones we have yet to discover.
What else do we know about the halo mass?
Yeah, I'm coming to it in a minute. So here then, so this region is not allowed. So for example, if the stellar neutrino mass is 2KeV, then the halo mass has to be, as we just saw earlier, 2.5 times 10 to the 12 or above. If it's 4KeV, then you get away with a smaller mass. So warm dark matter, and then you can see here that there is a line here that's flattening off. So let me call this the too small to succeed problem. So CDM has a too big to fail. With all these Frank dots and all these, now the danger is too small to succeed. And warm dark matter for a small mass has a too small to succeed problem. Okay, now, so, and you can see here that regardless of the warm dark matter mass, if the halo mass is less than 1.1 times 10 to the 12th, it's a 95% confidence in here, then stellar neutrinos are dead. So, to your question, what is the mass of the Milky Way? Well, here's a compilation of results, all recent, by all competent people. And they range from 5 times 10 to the 11 to 5 times 10 to the 12. There's an order of magnitude. Monsieur? Well, this is all right. This is M200. There's a standard definition that I wish everybody would follow. It's the mass out to some fiducial radius where the mean density interior to that radius equals to 200 times the critical density of the universe. So that's what we define by the mass of the halo. But, you know, most of these are expressed like that. There are some diehards who use M100, but it's easy to convert from one to the other. So there's a factor of 10 uncertainty. Now, you'd think astronomers, they get paid so well. It's a one here. They should know what the mass of the Milky Way is to a factor, but they don't. And this is very, very depressing because if we could nail this number, we could find out what the dark matter is. Anyway, so what I've told you so far is that CDM is ruled out unless the mass of the Milky Way halo is small. Warm dark matter is ruled out unless the mass of the Milky Way halo is large. Very, very nice. But I told you there was a loophole. And the loophole is unless Banyan effects are important. So let me spend 2 minutes with these Banyan effects. And yes, Alice is going to talk about that. So let me just give you a little bit of history. It's one of the privileges of old age. There are very few I can tell you. This is one of those, that you remember things that happened, particularly things your students did. And this was Ben Moore in 94, came into my office singing and dancing, said, I've ruled out CDM because DDO154 has a core radius. Here's a plot of the circular velocity, the rotation curves I've been showing. Here are data from Carignan, and this is what CDM predicts. And he said, clearly, not just one, actually four of those, they're ruled out. So this is my student telling me that what I've spent my life doing is ruled out. So you know, you ought to show who's boss. So I then immediately thought, look, it's a piece of cake. But by the way, before that, I tell you what the piece of cake is. Ben, as he likes to do, had kind of glossed over a few things. In fact, the data changed. Here, another of my postdocs, Sergio Gelato, in 2000 showed that actually the data had changed. Here you see CDM is not that ruled out. It's a bit ruled out. So anyway, so here is the idea. The idea is this. Imagine you have a cold dark matter halo, okay? And imagine you have gas, and the gas just cools, as gas does, because it dissipates, and it sinks to the middle. It becomes denser and denser. Let's suppose it stays as gas. Then eventually it becomes self-gravitating. Once it's self-gravitating, it begins to draw in dark matter, called adiabatic contraction, and then all the gravity is now in the baryons, and now light up a match, have a starburst, right? Then what will happen with the starburst is the gas will be ejected, but the mass leaves, and so does the binding energy, because the binding energy was in the gas, right? You don't look like you believe me, but no, not you, him. It's a particle physicist. You're an astronomer. You're okay. Now, so all right. So here's what happened. So here is a CDM density profile. So we did this and process, and you can see that depending on the strength of this phenomenon, you can reduce the central density if you wish, or you could actually make a core. So it doesn't depends on the strength of the process. Now, so these were, and then indeed, just to spite Ben, here's we showed that for these four in this paper by Navarro and Vincik, sorry, not W, sorry, it's me, Frank, sorry. Blame it on jet lag. But anyway, so we show that these four galaxies, you can, with this process, account for the rotation curve. Now, these were sort of fairly, you know, idealized simulations. Sorry about that. Fairly idealized simulations. And but it does happen. You know, in Paris simulations, it happened. It happens a lot more in Allison simulations, but here is those simulations of the Aquarius halo. It's famous of Halo 33, which at redshift 3 or so did exactly that. Right? It had a collapse of baryons, shown here in blue. It blew up, and its halo profile flattened. So this is of Halo 33, but it was so disrupted by this explosion that then it became very loosely bound and then never made it to the present day. It actually died off by tidal stripping well before redshift zero. So this happens, but happens rarely, at least in our simulations. It happens more in Allison simulations. So anyway, let me now conclude then. So what I've been arguing is that the satellite galaxies, puny and discriminated against as they have been for many years, are actually the key to understanding the nature of the dark matter from an astronomical point of view. And the two properties that are crucial for these tests are the luminosity function of satellites and the abundance of the most massive satellites. And here is a summary of what I've said. So CDM has no problems with the satellite luminosity function. That is not a problem. But it does, in principle, have a too big to fail problem unless the halo mass is less than about 1.5 times 10 to the 12, or unless baryon effects, I should say, baryon effects by reducing the central density make CDM look like one dark matter, if you like, and can do the same thing. You don't even have a core. You need to reduce the central density. And so that's another possible solution to this too big to fail problem. Now, warm dark matter does not make enough satellites unless the enough subhalos, unless the parent halo mass, the Milky Way halo mass, is bigger than 1.2 times 10 to the 12. It doesn't suffer from a too big to fail problem. And so it all now boils down to the experimental physicists who might find a particle in an experiment, or to the observational astronomers who may one day be able to tell us what the mass of the Milky Way halo is, and then we'll know. Okay, and I'm done.
Just a quick comment on the missing satellites non-problem. So it's true that a lot of progress has been made over the decades coming up with a very nice explanation for why the observations do not match the theoretical predictions, right? But there has been essentially no progress on actually solving the real problem.
Well, the observations match the theoretical predictions.
That's right, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, sorry.
But no, right, but the question of, are there small dark satellites around the Milky Way, for example, has not been addressed or answered, or no progress has been made towards that over the past
So this is a very interesting question, Greg. So let me just say one thing. So I should have said the satellite problem as expressed in this way, right, with luminosity function. To be totally fair to Ben Moore, who was the fair clipping, who were the first people to draw attention to this, they didn't express it in this way, because they knew this is not a problem. They expressed it in terms of circular velocity. So they had a bit of the too big to fail problem in there. So in that case, then it is more like the too big to fail. But anyway, so let me answer your question. So I think the CDM is right, then the Milky Way should be teeming with small dark halos, too small to make a galaxy because of this physics that I talked about. And in principle, they're detectable. They're detectable, for example, through millilensing, this flux anomaly, the flux ratio anomaly, that when you have a very good alignment between, say, a quasar and a galaxy, then you get anomalies in the lensing.
And now, if there's no gamma rays coming from the dark matter, that may be the only way to detect them.
That may be the only way, yes. The other way is through gamma rays. But so this, the interesting thing about the millilensing, it's another open astronomical program, because there are only five quasars known for which this phenomenon has been observed. And the paradox is that if you interpret these data, there's a series of papers using the Aquarius simulations by Dan Dan Shu and Shu Demao and me and other people, where the paradox is that you actually infer from this flux ratio anomaly even more substructure than in CDM, let alone warm dark matter. Mm. So this is one way, and I think here the physics are understood. It's a question of getting more bigger samples, and there's a version of this test that can be done with ALMAS, it happens. So that we'll find out about soon. And the other one is, of course, the one you mentioned, if we could detect them in gamma rays, which
there's there's disruption of streams too, but that's much harder, right?
Well, not necessarily. So Ray Calvert came up with a very neat idea that if you have streams in a lumpy halo, then you get gaps just because of the fluctuations in gravitational potential. And in principle, Gaia should be able possibly to tell us about these streams. So I think the prospects for finding the dark substructures are good. So there's gamma rays, there's lensing, and then there is these gaps in the streams. And you know, some of the streams would do really weird things, like they'll turn a sharp corner, for example, and then you know there was something dark there that did that.
So I have a quick naive question from watching your movie.
Oh, yes.
I would think that based on the later structure formation and the warm dark matter, there might be some bound you could place from knowing that reionization happens relatively early.
Ah, yes. Now, this is a great problem, and it's not solved at all. So it's not at all clear that there is enough structure to produce reionization in the standard way. So that we don't yet know, and we're working on that. But it's difficult because you saw these simulations produce all these unwanted spurious objects. So that's a kind of big limitation. However, in the case of warm dark, so in the CDM, we think that reionization was done by the UV light from the first stars, and we now know quasars don't contribute much as the first stars. Now the question that gets, but there are other ways to reionize the universe, and one interesting possibility in warm dark matter.
Physics job now. Huh? It's a particle physics job now.
Well, but no, it's even an astronomy job. So there is a paper that came out from my institute. I didn't want to be an author of that. By Gao and Tunes, even though it made it to the front cover of Science. Right? Now, I didn't want to be an author because I hadn't done any work for it, but and also I didn't believe the answer, but who knows? So these guys argued, they're my colleagues, my postdoc and one of my guys, who showed that, or argued that in these filaments, there could be star formation outside dark matter halos. And the reason they argued that is not that absurd. It's because the density, these are caustics, the sort of caustics that we've heard about, in these caustics, the density gets well above the required density for making stars. And so it could be that the filaments make stars and they reionize the universe. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that they may form black holes, which then accrete and produce X-rays, and the X-rays are also good at reionizing. So they may be non-orthodox ways of reionizing the universe. But I'm not convinced yet that the standard way of, I meant to point to Pierre that the caustics are there in the simulation. Sorry, I forgot to show that, but you saw them very beautifully in warm dark matter, right? So the eucaustics are actually there, but they're not regular, you know, they're all over the place. In any case, so there may be non-orthodox, non-standard ways of reionizing the universe in this kind of cosmology, but it is a very interesting constraint. So if what we need to do is just first find out whether this traditional way works or not. Yes.
So you mentioned that like a baryonic effect can reduce the central densities, but do you have enough baryons to do the job for you?
Well, that's a very good question. So what happened when we did the Navarro-Ig and white paper, front paper. This was 1996, all right? I mean, some of you weren't even born then, but so why, then Omega Baryon was bigger, okay. Right? So Omega Baryon divided by Omega Total was actually larger. So it became easy to do that. So then I subsequently said that was my worst paper ever because Omega Baryon then dropped and it becomes harder. But actually, Allison will show you that in her simulations, and you saw it in Subhalo 33 with Owen Paris simulations, these things maybe do happen. I'm skeptical personally that this is really what's going on. But yes, so, but you know, it is, yes, so there are enough baryons in theory. There may be other problems with the idea, but I mean, the main trick, right? The main thing is that the gas has to remain gaseous and become self-gravitating before it blows out. And the question is whether the gas can be supported at those very high densities without having turned into stars before that happens. So that's the key. So if it, indeed gas can remain gaseous at the level required to be responsible for the binding energy, then this works. But that is the key point. Would the gas turn into stars before it gets into that very centrally concentrated state? And I don't think we know the answer. Well, we'll see what Allison has to say, but I don't think we know the answer to that.
Okay.
Well, I'll answer yes okay. Or no.
The answer.
Okay. Okay. So I have a quick, well, I guess maybe two quick comments. For one thing, on your the plot you had from your paper, Wang.
Yeah.
With, so, you know, you express it in terms of the virial radius, but we don't actually know what the virial radius is. So I remember talking with Mike Boyle and Colchin. He said what you really want to do is count subhalos within a fixed physical radius instead of, you know.
Yeah, we did that in that paper
because
as well.
Okay.
And it's the same, you get the same answer.
Okay, the second thing is, in reading Mark's paper, the thing that, okay, drives me crazy about all the different warm dark matter papers is that everyone reports their limits using a different sterile neutrino or warm dark matter candidate,
yes.
When really the thing that you're probing is the sort of point at which the transfer function drops by a factor of 2 or 3 or something like that from the CDM. So I would implore you for the next papers to write down like a physical like length scale, not just like some, you know, sterile or warm dark.
We got even better, we got a dimensionless number, alpha. So you see it, I have a paper in my bag. So I completely agree with you. So we can compare results from Fran-Am-Am Alpha Forest and so on. You need to be speaking the same language. And
yes,
no, I agree. So our next paper has this.
Okay,
so
thank you.
Quite quick.
Yeah, that was good. Yes. Well, first of all, we've already established that I am older than you.
Yeah.
And, right. So I remember when you were telling us that Omega Matter was one.
I do.
And so I just counsel people who are interested in measuring the mass of the Milky Way halo not to pay any attention to this controversy and to just go ahead and make the measurements the best they can. That's one thing. The second thing is you showed us this warm dark matter simulation and the discussion about the small satellites and the big satellites and all of that depended on clipping out this computational artifact.
Yes.
And so those of us who, you know, just look at these things worry whether there is some underlying problem or whether the computations have some feature that has not been properly accounted for. So I think it's probably wise to reserve judgment on the issue of the satellite population in the warm dark matter population until it really comes out of the calculation in a way that looks good at the beginning.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I mean, I think the I think the procedure we have is pretty robust because these stick out like a sore thumb. I mean, they're like cosmic ray hits on a CCD. You just don't count them. No, because they eventually. There, it's just that it artificially fragmented, and you know, produces gravity. Eventually, they fall into the big halo and they get virialized. So they're only a problem while they're still discrete. But the thing is, they stick out like a sore thumb. I mean, they.
And we all believe you, and we're going to have to take this to the coffee break and let Allison
just
talk.
Say, in Lovell's paper, it's all, it's the most boring paper. Right. It's 10 pages of how you do it.
Mic.
There are techniques to try and fix it.
So, this new paper by et al. And Hahn and
So let's thank Carlos again. So our next speaker here to provide a rebuttal to Carlos is Allison Brooks talking about hot gas. No, baryons. All right, baryons, here we go.
That was not the